the forbidden seepage of technological development which came from the edges of humankind's farthest migrations nibbled at the central power. Products permitted the Ixion and Tlaalaxu factories could not relieve the pressure. And always in the wings there stood Faradin of House Carino, inheritor of Shaddam IV's titles and claims. Without the Fremen, without House Atreides' monopoly on the geriatric spice, her grip would loosen. All the power would dissolve. She could feel it slipping from her right now. People heeded this preacher. It would be dangerous to silence him, just as dangerous as it was to let him continue preaching such words as he'd shouted across her square today. She could see the first omens of her own defeat, and the pattern of the problem stood out clearly in her mind. The Bene Gesserits had codified the problem. A large populace held in check by a small but powerful force is quite a common situation in our universe, and we know the major conditions wherein this large populace may turn upon its keepers. 1. When they find a leader. This is the most volatile threat to the powerful. They must retain control of leaders. 2. When the populace recognizes its chains. Keep the populace blind and unquestioning. 3. When the populace perceives a hope of escape from bondage. They must never even believe that escape is possible. Alia shook her head, feeling her cheeks tremble with the force of movement. The signs were here in her populace. Every report she received from her spies throughout the Imperium reinforced her certain knowledge. Unceasing warfare of the Fremen Jihad left its mark everywhere. Wherever the ecumenism of the sword had touched, people retained the attitude of a subject population, defensive, concealing, evasive. All manifestations of authority, and this meant essentially religious authority, became subject to resentment. Oh, pilgrims still came in their thronging millions, and some among them were probably devout, but for the most part, pilgrimage had other motivations than devotion. Most often it was a canny surety for the future. It emphasized obedience and gained a real form of power which was easily translated into wealth. The Haji who returned from Arrakis came home to new authority, new social status. The Haji could make profitable economic decisions which the planet-bound of his homeworld dared not challenge. Alia knew the popular riddle. What do you see inside the empty purse brought home from Dune? And the answer? The eyes of Muad'Dib. Fire diamonds. The traditional ways to counter growing unrest paraded themselves before Alia's awareness. People had to be taught that opposition was always punished, and assistance to the ruler was always rewarded. Imperial forces must be shifted in random fashion. Major adjuncts to imperial power had to be concealed. Every movement by which the Regency countered potential attack required delicate timing to keep the opposition off balance. "Have I lost my sense of timing?" she wondered.
"What idle speculation is this?" a voice within her asked.
She felt herself growing calmer. Yes, the Baron's plan was a good one. We eliminate the threat of the Lady Jessica, and, at the same time, we discredit House Carino. Yes. The preacher could be dealt with later. She understood his posture. The symbolism was clear. He was the ancient spirit of unbridled speculation, the spirit of heresy alive and functioning in her desert of orthodoxy. That was his strength. It didn't matter whether he was Paul, as long as that could be kept in doubt. But her Bene Gesserit knowledge told Alia that his strength would contain the key to his weakness.
"The preacher has a flaw which we will find. I will have him spied upon, watched every moment. And if the opportunity arises, he will be discredited."
"I will not argue with the Fremen claims that they are divinely inspired to transmit a religious revelation. It is their concurrent claim to ideological revelation which inspires me to shower them with derision. Of course they make the dual claim in the hope that it will strengthen their mandarinate and help them to endure in a universe which finds them increasingly oppressive. It is in the name of all those oppressed people that I warn the Fremen. Short-term expediency always fails in the long term."
The preacher at Arrakeen. Leto had come up in the night with Stilgar to the narrow ledge at the crest of the low rock outcropping which Seech Tabor called the Attendant. Under the waning light of second moon, the ledge gave them a panoramic view. The shield wall with Mount Idaho to the north, the great flat to the south, and rolling dunes eastward toward Habanya Ridge. Winding dust, the aftermath of a storm, hid the southern horizon. Moonlight frosted the rim of the shield wall. Stilgar had come against his will, joining the secret adventure finally because Leto aroused his curiosity. Why was it necessary to risk a sand crossing in the night? The lad had threatened to sneak away and make the journey alone if Stilgar refused. The way of it bothered him profoundly, though. Two such important targets alone in the night. Leto squatted on the ledge facing south toward the flat. Occasionally he pounded his knee as though in frustration. Stilgar waited. He was good at silent waiting, and stood 2 paces to one side of his charge, arms folded, his robe moving softly in the night breeze. For Leto, the sand crossing represented a response to inner desperation, a need to seek a new alignment for his life in a silent conflict which Ganyma could no longer risk. He had maneuvered Stilgar into sharing the journey, because there were things Stilgar had to know in preparation for the days ahead. Again Leto pounded his knee. It was difficult to know a beginning. He felt at times like an extension of those countless other lives, all as real and immediate as his own. In the flow of those lives there was no ending, no accomplishment, only eternal beginning. They could be a mob, too, clamoring at him as though he were a single window through which each desired to peer. And there lay the peril which had destroyed Alia. Leto stared outward at the moonlight silvering the storm remnants. Folds and overfolds of dunes spread across the flat, silica grit measured out by the winds, mounded into waves, pea sand, grit sand, pebbles. He felt himself caught in one of those poised moments just before dawn. Time pressed at him. It was already the month of Akkad, and behind him lay the last of an interminable waiting time. Long hot days and hot dry winds, nights like this one tormented by gusts and endless blowings from the furnace lands of the Hawkblood. He glanced over his shoulder toward the shield wall, a broken line in starlight. Beyond that wall in the northern sink lay the focus of his problems. Once more he looked to the desert. As he stared into the hot darkness, day dawned, the sun rising out of dust scarves and placing a touch of lime into the storm's red streamers. He closed his eyes, willing himself to see how this day would appear from Arakeen, and the city lay there in his consciousness, caught up like a scattering of boxes between the light and the new shadows. Desert. Boxes. Desert. Boxes. When he opened his eyes, the desert remained, a spreading curry expanse of wind-kicked sand. Oily shadows along the base of each dune reached out like rays of the night just past. They linked one time with the other. He thought of the night, squatting here with Stilgar restless beside him, the older man worried at the silence and the unexplained reasons for coming to this place. Stilgar must have many memories of passing this way with his beloved Muad'Dib. Even now Stilgar was moving, scanning all around, alert for dangers. Stilgar did not like the open in daylight. He was pure old Fremen in that. Leto's mind was reluctant to leave the night and the clean exertions of a sand crossing. Once here in the rocks, the night had taken on its black stillness. He sympathized with Stilgar's daylight fears. Black was a single thing, even when it contained boiling terrors. Light could be many things. Night held its fear smells and its things which came with slithering sounds. Dimensions separated in the night, everything amplified, thorns sharper, blades more cutting. But terrors of the day could be worse. Stilgar cleared his throat. Leto spoke without turning. "I have a very serious problem, Still."
"So I surmised."
The voice beside Leto came low and wary. The child had sounded disturbingly of the father. It was a thing of forbidden magic which touched a chord of revulsion in Stilgar. Fremen knew the terrors of possession. Those found possessed were rightfully killed, and their water cast upon the sand, lest it contaminate the tribal cistern. The dead should remain dead. It was correct to find one immortality in children, but children had no right to assume too exact a shape from their past.
"My problem is that my father left so many things undone," Leto said, "especially the focus of our lives. The Empire cannot go on this way still, without a proper focus for human life. I am speaking of life, you understand? Life, not death."
"Once, when he was troubled by a vision, your father spoke in this vein to me," Stilgar said.
Leto found himself tempted to pass off that questioning fear beside him with a light response, perhaps a suggestion that they break their fast. He realized that he was very hungry. They had eaten the previous noon, and Leto had insisted on fasting through the night. But another hunger drew him now.
"The trouble with my life is the trouble with this place," Leto thought. "No preliminary creation. I just go back and back and back until distances fade away. I cannot see the horizon. I cannot see Habanya Ridge. I can't find the original place of testing.
There is really no substitute for prescience, Leto said. Perhaps I should risk the spice and be destroyed as your father was?
A dilemma, Leto said.
Once your father confided in me that knowing the future too well was to be locked into that future to the exclusion of any freedom to change.
The paradox which is our problem, Leto said. It's a subtle and powerful thing, prescience. The future becomes now. To be sighted in the land of the blind carries its own perils. If you try to interpret what you see for the blind, you tend to forget that the blind possess an inherent movement conditioned by their blindness. They are like a monstrous machine moving along its own path. They have their own momentum, their own fixations. I fear the blind still. I fear them. They can so easily crush anything in their path.
Stilgar stared at the desert. Lime dawn had become steel day. He said,
"Why have we come to this place?"
"Because I wanted you to see the place where I may die."
Stilgar tensed. Then,
"So you have had a vision?"
"Perhaps it was only a dream."
"Why do we come to such a dangerous place?"
Stilgar glared down at his charge.
"We will return at once."
"I won't die today, Still."
"No? What was this vision?"
"I saw three paths," Leto said. His voice came out with a sleepy sound of remembrance. "One of those futures requires me to kill our grandmother."
Stilgar shot a sharp glance back toward Siege Tabor, as though he feared the Lady Jessica could hear them across the sandy distance.
"Why?"
"To keep from losing the spice monopoly."
"I don't understand."
"Nor do I. But that is the thought of my dream when I used the knife."
"Oh."
Stilgar understood the use of a knife. He drew a deep breath.
"What is the second path?"
"Ghani and I marry to seal the Atreides bloodline."
"Gah!"
Stilgar expelled his breath in a violent expression of distaste.
"It was usual in ancient times for kings and queens to do this," Leto said. "Ghani and I have decided we will not breed."
"I warn you to hold fast in that decision."
There was death in Stilgar's voice. By Fremen law, incest was punishable by death on the hanging tripod. He cleared his throat, asked,
"And the third path?"
"I am called to reduce my father to human stature."
"He was my friend, Muad'Dib," Stilgar muttered.
"He was your god. I must undeify him."
Stilgar turned his back on the desert, stared toward the oasis of his beloved Siege Tabor. Such talk always disturbed him. Leto sensed the sweaty smell of Stilgar's movement. It was such a temptation to avoid the purposeful things which had to be said here. They could talk half the day away, moving from the specific to the abstract as though drawn away from real decisions, from those immediate necessities which confronted them. And there was no doubt that House Carino posed a real threat to real lives, his own and Ghani's. But everything he did now had to be weighed and tested against the secret necessities. Stilgar once had voted to have Faradin assassinated, holding out for the subtle application of Chalmerky, poison administered in a drink. Faradin was known to be partial to certain sweet liquors. That could not be permitted.
"If I die here still," Leto said, "you must beware of Alia. She is no longer your friend."
"What is this talk of death and your aunt?"
Now Stilgar was truly outraged.
"Kill the Lady Jessica? Beware of Alia? Die in this place?"
"Small men change their faces at her command," Leto said. "A ruler need not be a prophet still, nor even godlike. A ruler need only be sensitive. I brought you here with me to clarify what our Imperium requires. It requires good government that does not depend upon laws or precedent, but upon the personal qualities of whoever governs."
"The Regency handles its imperial duties quite well," Stilgar said. "When you come of age..."
"I am of age. I'm the oldest person here. You're a puling infant beside me. I can remember times more than 50 centuries past. Ha! I can even remember when we Fremen were on Thurgrad."
"Why do you play with such fancies?" Stilgar demanded, his tone peremptory.
Leto nodded to himself. Why indeed? Why recount his memories of those other centuries? Today's Fremen were his immediate problem, most of them still only half-tamed savages, prone to laugh at unlucky innocence.